They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Welcome back and Merry Christmas to our listening audience. Elliot, there's one big piece of movie news this week. We have the subject of Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer follow-up. He is doing an adaptation of Homer's The Odyssey. Elliot, what are your thoughts on this? I'm sure you're excited for the movie because it's Nolan and you're a big fan, but does this make you more excited? Is this something you're excited to see him tackle? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. This is absolutely 100% not what I was expecting. I would be surprised to find the Nolan fan or even just movie watcher who was like, you know what my prediction for Nolan's next movie is? The Odyssey. I don't want to sound like I'm not excited. Obviously I am, and I have confidence in Nolan. I guess I'm still just kind of reeling because The Odyssey is such a sweeping, romantic, epic kind of story that is really not in keeping with Nolan's much more refined, controlled, highly intellectual stories that he chooses to tell. So, I don't know. I feel like every time Nolan has been doubted, whether it's with casting Heath Ledger as Joker or taking on a World War II film, I feel like he's delivered. So, I would say that whatever my surprise is at this revelation, the safe money is, as always, on Nolan.
Interesting. This made me more excited for it. I think every time Nolan, I guess since Tenet, which isn't that long ago, so it hasn't happened that much, but I think I was a little afraid that Nolan was going to go back and do another science fiction thing, which I would have been excited for, but I would have been a little disappointed to see him kind of return to the well, so to speak, where Dunkirk is one of my favorite Nolan movies because of how different it is from all of his other movies. And I think Dunkirk is a perfect example. I mean, it's also a story of people trying to get home, so it's got a couple of things in common with The Odyssey. But I think in terms of the story it's telling, I think my fondness for Dunkirk makes me very excited to see what Nolan does with The Odyssey. I'm very interested to see, how fantastical he wants to get with it, because the book is has quite a few fantastical elements, especially in the bulk of Odysseus's journey home. He encounters a lot of different mythical creatures and mythical people who hinder that journey for him. So I'm interested to see if he decides to go with some of those elements, or if he decides to purge it, like I believe the new Ralph Fiennes Odyssey movie does. That one doesn't have the Cyclops, it doesn't have Circe. I assume it doesn't have the, like, vortex monster thing. So I'm interested to see what he does with it, but I'm very excited for it. Every time a director does something that's kind of outside of what they normally do, I get really excited, because I think that's where we separate the wheat from the chaff when it comes to directors. That it's like, sure, you can do a good sci-fi. Can you do a good war movie? Can you do a good, like, this? I mean, that's one of the reasons for me that Kubrick is always going to be a top five director, because his ability to make good movies in almost every genre is almost unparalleled. So I'm very excited to see Nolan trying to, maybe not trying to, but I'm excited to see Nolan branch out and do other things than just science fiction and those, yeah, kind of tightly knotted intellectual, densely plotted movies that he's done in the past.
Well, I mean, you've kind of hit upon, we don't know what exactly Nolan's approach will be, if he will try to bring his out of sequence, highly intellectual style to the film. Because one of the things that I actually get after Kubrick a little bit about is how in all of those movies that he does, each and every one of them feels distinctly Kubrickian.
Yeah.
In contrast to someone like Damien Chazelle, who I rarely have much good to say about, but whose movies, I think none of them, I don't think that Damien Chazelle has a particular style, and I mean that as a compliment, that he is always changing, he's always innovating, he's always trying to do new things. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of approach Nolan wants to take with such a different kind of story.
Sure. Well, I guess I will say The Odyssey, the book, is already non-linear. So he's got that already baked in. He can do non-linear and still be very true to it. But yeah, I'm really excited for it. I'm very interested in it. I've already started trying to think about who in the cast is going to be which character in the, that, like, Tom Holland's in the movie. I bet Tom Holland is playing Odysseus's son. I think Matt Damon is the other bigger person. I'd be surprised if Matt Damon is playing Odysseus, but could be. I don't know. It's really, I'm really excited for this. I read The Odyssey just, like, earlier this year, so, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. So I think that's the other thing that's got me excited for this movie, is just being able to enter into it as like, oh, I'm kind of a fan of this property, so I'm interested to see how it's adapted.
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out. When is it supposed to come out? 2026?
Yeah, 2026.
Yep. So we got 2 years to think on all this.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have less than 2 years to discuss our movie of the week. I can do the introduction for this one because I picked it kind of at the recommendation of Jake Brend, who you might recognize as the voice of the intro for Magellan's at the Movies. You heard him earlier. He watched this movie for the first time and he said that he enjoyed it more than he expected. So I thought, why not do Love Actually? This is, I would say, a 2000s favorite for a lot of people. It's a Christmas favorite for a lot of people. Elliot, I feel pretty safe in saying that neither of us have seen this movie before. So I'm always excited to watch movies that other people really like for the first time and then be able to talk about it here on the podcast. I have managed to avoid any spoilers, but Elliot, let's leap into this review. Why don't you start us off with your first thoughts and opinions on Love Actually?
Okay. So actually, because of the holiday season, Nathan and I have been in semi-regular contact recently, and we've kind of been dancing around this movie and our feelings on it. But I can reveal now that this movie is okay. Wow. And actually, recently we've been watching movies that I have either really liked or really disliked. So I actually found it kind of nice to watch a movie that I was just like, yeah, that was all right. I liked it. I liked parts of it. There were parts of it that I hated, but we'll get into that. But as a package, I thought this movie was fine. I definitely have plenty of thoughts about characters and construction and just the general conceit of the movie, much of which I'm sure we'll get into. But yeah, just for high level thoughts, I enjoyed, I would say, most of the disparate threads that this movie, if you didn't know, this movie is about, I think it's like 8 or 9 separate,
nine
holiday love stories, stories about people falling in love, finding love, being in love. So there's quite a few, too many to get into right now, but basically it's all love all the time. And so I think that that's a lot, and that's always a gamble, because with every new strand that you add, you are running the risk of essentially invalidating or canceling any potential for an audience. If an audience member doesn't respond to one of those threads, then that automatically makes, right, like 10% of the movie they will just really struggle to connect with. Yeah. And that definitely comes to bite the movie in the storylines that are less enjoyable and less compelling. But yeah, I thought on the whole it was fine. There were some definite charms to it, and some parts where I did laugh.
That's really cool that that's how you feel about this movie, because I think I feel almost exactly the same. This is so neat when we watch a movie for the first time and we have the same opinion. I couldn't agree more with the perils of doing a multi-plot or kind of intertwining storyline as is being done here. I think I found the conceit of the movie to be trying to look at love in a lot of different, just through a lot of different lenses, and trying to look at a lot of different types of love that this has, you know, young love, forbidden love, you know, kind of romantic love, it's got other types of love, you know, kind of brotherly love, a love of siblings. And so I think that's interesting. And I think love is a interesting premise for a movie. And so, yeah, I agree. I think some of these storylines I was into and was enjoying, and I laughed at them. And some of these storylines I really aggressively wanted them to end. So maybe I told you we were going to do this. Let's start with this. Let's do maybe our favorite and least favorite plots of the 9, and we'll maybe start from there.
Okay. Are you wanting me to go first?
Well, you can go first, or I can go first. I can go first and say I hated Colin so much.
I hated Colin so much.
I thought this was, we kind of danced around which one was our least favorite when I told you, like, hey, be ready to do favorite and least favorite. And everything you said about your least favorite, I'm like, I'm thinking that might be mine too. Yeah, I couldn't stand Colin. It's an uncompelling story. His story is just, he keeps striking out because he's a hateful misogynist who is just awful to be around. And so he decides to go to America, where he instantly, I don't know, lands on the set of an adult video inexplicably, and manages to stumble his way into meeting some women. It's awful. It's unpleasant to watch. It's thankfully, I would say, probably one of the shortest stories, and we don't go back to it that often. It doesn't connect to the other storylines very much, but it is a genuinely awful experience. There's nothing that I enjoy about it. I just can't stand Colin.
Yeah, I have very little to add there. Every time we cut back to his stupid face, my eyes just hit the ceiling, because I was so bored and disinterested in this mangy little twerp's quest for some action. And yeah, the way it ends is just absurd. The way he just, like, these women, he just falls into a threesome with these women. And I was like, I don't even know what I was like, but it was unpleasant. I watched this alone, which is probably for the best, because I think at that point I would have been getting pretty ornery. Yeah, this, I don't even understand what this segment is supposed to contribute. Like, I understand, honestly, I think that calling these stories intertwined is a little bit generous, because it's more like 9 separate stories that occasionally feature cameos from the other storylines.
Sure, yeah.
And this one is one of the most disconnected from the others. And I definitely agree that I like the conceit of this movie of looking at love from a variety of perspectives. I don't know that the movie fully delivers on that conceit, but again, we'll get into that later. But all that to say that this is by far the least interesting and least compelling perspective, because it's just stupid. And like you said, the main character, Colin, is just an objectionable human being.
Yeah. To move to maybe a more positive note, I would say I have the other storylines. There are ones that I don't love that much, but
hey, love.
Wow, good one. Collins is my least favorite by a country, is a lot worse than the other ones. That if there was 2 other storylines that were as bad as that one, I think that would really hurt this movie's chances of being very enjoyable. My favorite, and it's kind of a toss-up between a couple, but I think my favorite was honestly the storyline with Martin Freeman and this other woman who's the actress name I can't recall, but they're playing 2 people who are lighting doubles on the set of a movie for a series of sex scenes. So they're having to enact these sex scenes to help the lighting people on this movie set figure out how to, like, light all of these scenes properly when the actual movie stars show up. I thought the premise of people doing, this might be very juvenile for me to laugh at, but the premise of them doing things that look very, you know, sexual in nature while having very casual conversations about how the roads were today, how cold it was today, I found funny and I laughed at. But I also thought it was a very cute story of, you know, they, as they're chatting in these little scenes, they get to know each other and then eventually they go out on a date and it's very cute. Well, we don't see the date, but we see after the date. And I thought it was a really cute sort of thing of separating that, like, they had both, at this point, seen each other naked and done all of this, you know, thing, all of these things on this movie set. But when it comes to the end of their first date, they're both, like, noticeably nervous to kiss each other, which I thought was a really cute, to the point of the movie, of like, wow, there's a lot of different shades of love and there's a lot of different, like, nuance to this sort of thing. I found it really cute to have a storyline where it's like, wow, this, you know, all of this other stuff was not connected to genuine feelings of love. So once it was a genuine romantic feeling for the other person, it changed, like, how they looked at each other. I don't know. I found it really cute. I found it very funny. I also thought it was simple enough that even though it doesn't get a ton of screen time, I felt like it really worked very well in developing the characters. Again, not like it was some super deep, amazing love story, but it was just simple enough, and I enjoyed it enough that it was my favorite, because it didn't... Some of my other favorites have some dings against them, some things that were like, I didn't love that. But this was the only one that I was like, yeah, I just really like... Every time it came back on, I was like, I find this funny, and I find it cute. So, I like it.
Wow. I would have to disagree. That storyline ranks barely above Colin for me.
Wow.
I felt like that was very underdeveloped. And it is kind of a consequence of the limited screen time that what we basically have is, I don't know, three or four scenes of them on the set talking about nothing. And clearly there's some level of attraction there. And then we have one scene of the post date. And then at the very end, there's a cameo of them and they're engaged. And I was like, wow, okay, that was kind of a waste of time. Because I would say that kind of similar to Colin's storyline, I feel like this is just a very thinly plotted and thinly characterized storyline that we know very vanishingly little about these two characters or the nature of their connection. And this is actually something that I've been thinking about recently, that it seems like I will often find very little favor in romantic subplots. And so I was wondering, like, is that just because I'm a crotchety, angry old man who dislikes people being happy? And that may be, I'm not going to lie, I'm not going to say that that's not part of it. Mm-hmm. But I do think that a bigger part of it is that I find movie romances very often seem to be based on a physical attraction rather than an emotional connection, which I just find so uninteresting and deeply uncompelling, because to me, the strongest, most compelling relationships are based on a connection rather than an attraction. And I think that this storyline is kind of guilty of that. And it's not like, I mean, it was a little harsh to say that it ranked just above Colin's storyline. Colin's storyline is, like, subterranean. So this storyline is at least in the open air in terms of rankings. But I still, yeah, I just thought it was way too underdeveloped for me to really get into it. And the fact that it just kind of, I don't know, it just kind of ends. Yeah, I found it to be pretty unsatisfying.
Interesting. Well, I think the best way to keep, you know...
That, do I not get to say what my favorite storyline was?
Oh, sure, I guess, if you want to. I was just going to say that I think the best way to move forward is for us to just talk about all of the storylines. So we don't have to rank them, but I think that's the easiest way to review this movie, given that there's so many different kind of like pieces. But yeah. Do your favorite.
So my favorite is, I've got the list here in front of me.
Wow.
And it's Billy Mack and Joe, which is a, for those who hadn't seen the movie, it's the story of a aging rock star who's put out an album, a Christmas album, and it's about him and his manager realizing that they care about each other as friends, and they're just sort of realizing their actual connection. So part of it is, I thought it was this was definitely the funniest storyline to me, because Billy Mack, the rock star, is very honest and droll, and he's played by Bill Nighy. And so there's a scene where he's giving an interview on the radio, and he's just talking about, he's like, oh man, this is a piece of trash album that I'm just trotting out to try to grasp at fame again. And the host is like, oh man, hey, kids, listen to this thing. And he just starts swearing. So I thought that was really funny. And then I felt like they had the sweetest ending where Billy Mack, he gets what he wanted. His album succeeds for reasons I don't really understand because they keep on talking about how terrible it is. But anyway, he decides to celebrate by hanging out with his manager, who he's been kind of disparaging and just making deprecating jokes towards throughout the whole movie. And I thought that was really nice. How it's just two friends being honest with each other and saying like, hey, I couldn't have done this without you. You're my friend, and you're the person who I want to celebrate with because that's what's most meaningful to me. And that gesture, I felt like was far and away the most meaningful to me and the most compelling to me because it entailed an actual sacrifice, an actual like demonstration of affection and care that wasn't just kind of a saccharine, overly sugary, just kind of spectacle. Like, right? Like, the thing between Colin Firth and his maid, or the thing that Rick from The Walking Dead does for Elizabeth from Pirates of the Caribbean. Those are both, like, over-the-top, sugary spectacles. And I just found the more reserved, realistic gesture to be a lot more compelling, and it got me right in the feels.
Wow, that was actually the one that I was juggling between for my favorite as well. I should have picked that, and then we could have kept the agreement rolling on this episode for a little longer, because it's very funny. And I think, to your point of it not being a saccharine big romantic sort of ending, I think this was the ending that caught me the most by surprise, I suppose, that all of the other ones ended in a way that I was like, yeah, of course Hugh Grant is gonna go and reconnect with the girl. Like, obviously that's how that storyline is gonna end, and a lot of the other storylines. It's not surprising that romantic storylines ended romantically. So this was the one where every time it returned to it, I was like, this is funny. I don't know where it's going. I don't know how it connects to this premise of love is everywhere. Love actually is everywhere, as Hugh Grant or whatever says at the beginning of the movie. So when it had the final scene with Bill Nighy just coming back and saying, hey, I don't want to spend Christmas with anyone other than you, the person who's helped me get to this place, I thought it was really sweet, and the sweetness was doubled or multiplied by how surprised I was that was the ending to this storyline. I especially after the Colin nonsense, I was very much ready to believe that this storyline was gonna end with Billy Mack meeting some girl at a party, and then like he'd be married in the final scene of the movie or something. So when it wasn't that, I was like, wow, this is really nice.
That is also what I thought.
Oh, well,
and
see.
So yeah, that's really nice. And I want to talk about the Colin Firth one next, and let me get the actual name up here. Jamie and Aurelia.
Okay.
And I just want to say that I totally mischaracterized this storyline.
Wow.
I don't know why, but so what happens is Jamie, Colin Firth, goes to the wedding of some other characters who will meet eventually. And he comes back. Or here's what I thought was happening. He goes to his brother's house and he talks to his brother, and his brother is a little awkward, and then some woman shouts some kind of incriminating sexual advance from off screen. And then Colin looked a little awkward, Jamie looked a little awkward, and the brother looked a little awkward, and I was like, what's going on here? It's just his brother hanging out with his wife. I don't understand what the problem is. And so then Jamie kind of moves out and goes to like a shack to write, and he gets this Aurelia. She's a Portuguese maid. And so they strike up this, like, rising relationship. And I was like, this is so messed up. He's cheating on his wife. What's he doing? This guy's terrible. I hate this storyline. And then, so it ended. And I was like, that was awful. I hated that. That's so stupid. Why are we romanticizing infidelity? And then I happened to read the Wikipedia article for this. And it said that his brother, he had gone back to his house,
yeah,
and his brother had been sleeping with his, Jamie's, wife.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know why I didn't pick up on that or why I thought that something else was happening, but it caused me to, like, at the last minute have to be, oh, wait, so that was actually just a standard, like, meet cute between these two characters, yeah, and Jamie is actually just a wounded man trying to recover. So I'm gonna really struggle to, like, evaluate this because my memory is colored by this perception that Jamie was being a scumbag when in fact, of course, he was just sort of recovering. So Nathan, you can tell me what you thought about the storyline, and I'll try to, like, follow along and see what happens.
Firstly, it's funny that you missed that. I watched this with my fiance, who really likes this movie and has seen it multiple times, and I did need her. I was pretty sure that the implication of the scene with his brother was that his brother had slept with Jamie's wife, and that's why he was upset. But I did have to get, like, a fact check on that. I had to ask Betsy, like, this is what just happened, right? Because I agree, it's not made incredibly clear. And then the only hint beyond that is that when the, like, landlord or whatever comes to the house, she does ask Jamie, like, hey, is the woman gonna be here too? And he says no.
See, I thought that was just because she was sick that at the beginning. Oh. The way that she, like, what I realize now, what she was doing is getting time for herself, yeah, to have this affair at the beginning, because she says that she can't go to the wedding with Jamie because she's sick.
Oh.
And so then when he said, my wife is, she's not coming here, I was like, oh, I guess she must still
be sick. She's still sick.
And so that just amplified. I know! That just amplified how angry I was with Jamie, that I was like, your sick wife, what are you doing, man?
But anyway, as to actually what I think about this storyline, I would group this with the Hugh Grant storyline in that it's the most meat and potatoes rom-com storylines in this movie. That some of the other storylines have are dealing with different sort of emotions. Colin Firth and Hugh Grant, their two storylines is just kind of a classic romance thing. In Colin Firth's case, he meets his maid, they kind of strike up a relationship somehow, for some reason they never get a translate. They both speak different languages, so I'm unsure as to the mechanics of their increasing fondness for each other given their inability to really have conversations with each other. But ignoring that, because we choose to ignore things when we watch movies, I think it's an okay storyline. It's got all of the classic rom-com sort of beats. It has a, like you said, a extravagant declaration of love. I thought it was cute that she also learned that she, in the time that he was learning Portuguese to communicate his feelings for her, she was learning English to communicate her feelings for him. That's not like a revelatory genius thing, but that's, I thought it was kind of cute. And I would group this with the Hugh Grant storyline because it operates on a very similar sort of trajectory, classic story arc. It's not incredible. I think I put both of these in my, like, medium tier plots of this movie. But I think they're both serviceable and they both, you know, communicate love as a rom-com communicates love, which is, you know, just kind of a take it or leave it sort of thing.
Yeah, okay. I don't know. I can't say. I guess I would have to rewatch the movie to have the correct perception of what's happening here. I do want to talk about Hugh Grant. Let's, again, check out the real names.
The real names.
The real fake names.
Hugh Grant and Lord Malvo as the American president.
Oh my gosh, that is so messed up. David and Natalie. David is the prime minister. Natalie is a housekeeper. They start making eyes at each other. She is accosted by the president. I can't believe a U.S. president would do something like this. That's absolutely unheard of. He dismisses her. He realizes, I can't be without this woman. So he goes after her. And by far, the joke that I laughed the most at was when he's knocking on doors trying to find her. And he finds these children. And they're like, are you a Christmas caroler? And he starts singing, and then he looks back at his bodyguard, and his bodyguard starts bringing it, just burst out into this beautiful rendition of Good King Wenceslas. I thought that was really funny, and it made that guy, Gavin is his name, be my favorite character for the entire movie.
Wow.
I felt like this one was the most Disney Channel-esque storyline. Because it's got this bizarre political subplot in it of, this is wild to me, that Lorne Malvo, it's Billy Bob Thornton actually, is the president of the U.S. And so he comes over there, he's on a state visit, and David's been recently elected, and I guess in this world, the U.S. has been pushing the U.K. around, gosh dang it. Again, I that's just insane to me that the U.S. would behave in such fashion towards its allies.
Pretty unrealistic, I would say.
I know. That just suspends my credulity. They have this like confrontational meeting where the U.S. president is like, I'll take whatever you give me as long as it's what I want. And then there's a press conference where David essentially pushes back on this, and first of all, everyone was really happy about that, and I was like, that's just words, that doesn't mean anything. You could say whatever you want to the public, so I felt like that was kind of strange. But also, they're talking about the special relationship. That's the term that in global politics is used to describe the relationship between the U.S. and the U.K., and it is a very important relationship. And David says, like, oh, the relationship is actually bad. And so all I could think about was the global implications of a cooling of ties between the U.S. and the U.K. on a global stage. That I was like, that is insane. That's going to be headlines like for weeks talking about this. But of course, the movie doesn't actually care about that. And again, it's very Disney Channel-y. That all you need to do in order to rectify a lopsided geopolitical relationship is just to say, he's being a little bit mean, actually, and we're not going to stand for that anymore, and then it's just all over. So that's my thoughts on the geopolitics of the storyline. The actual romance, I thought was fine. I mean, Hugh Grant, he's a charming guy. I've been seeing him lately in, like, non-Hugh Grant roles, like in The Gentleman. I think he's very talented. But yeah, this is a pretty standard role for him. And I liked Natalie, and I liked David, and I thought that they were fine. They were cute. But yeah, I would probably agree that this is a mid-tier storyline in the movie.
Yeah. As soon as Billy Bob Thornton showed up, I lost any ability to think about the movie because I just kept thinking, like, man, I hope him and Martin Freeman don't meet up. We're really going to have trouble.
He should have said, you have a blessed day to the prime minister.
You have a blessed day. Aces.
Aces.
Anyway, the next storyline that I would like to tackle just kind of briefly, because I don't have a ton to say about this, is the one with Elizabeth from Pirates of the Caribbean and Rick Grimes from The Walking Dead. This is probably the most iconic.
Juliet, Peter, and Mark.
Sure. You could have said any three names there, and I would have believed you.
Tom, Dick, and Harry.
Oh, of course. This is maybe the most iconic of the storylines because it ends with the iconic poster board love confession. I think the storyline is pretty... I would put this as my second least favorite. I think the premise of one of those names that you just said being in love, in secret love with his best friend's now wife,
Mark.
I feel like that's something you should work through and get over way before your best man at their wedding. And you should certainly shouldn't exacerbate the situation by a romantic Christmas confession. And then you should especially shouldn't kiss the person who does that. I just thought it was kind of a whack storyline. I was not a fan of the characters. It's another one of the storylines that doesn't get a ton of screen time, which is good, because if it had more screen time, I think it would have annoyed me even more. As it stands, I wasn't in like a white hot rage like I was every time Colin showed up, but I was a little annoyed every time it came back, because I was like, there's no ending to this that I'm gonna be like happy about or satisfied with, or is gonna leave me with some sense of like, wow, all of those characters acted in a really healthy and mature way. And then it ended, and I was right. They didn't, and it's, you know, I guess it's another shade of love. I would not say it's a shade of love that we should be romanticizing, personally.
Yeah, I would agree. I feel like movies are constantly trying to push these kinds of relationships, these love triangles, with an established relationship, a marriage or a courtship or something like that, and kind of your wild card forming the third point of the triangle, who's outside of it, but the outsider looking in, who is in love with one of the other points.
Mm-hmm.
And it rarely, I feel like it's just one of those things, the movies very rarely are honest, I feel, about what this kind of situation entails, and the real life kind of, I don't know, like you were saying, the actual reaction that you should probably go with if you find yourself in such a situation. because, yeah, it's mostly, if it's not one of the woman usually breaking up with her established relationship and pursuing a relationship with the third wheel, then it is something like this where it's treated as kind of a, oh, isn't that so cute? I guess they're just going to have to, like, crush on each other in secret. Which I find very unsatisfying and very unrealistic. excuse me. The movie 13 Going on 30, of all movies, actually what? Has a fairly realistic, mature approach to a relationship of this kind, where it's actually portrayed as, man, it's just a bad situation. Like, there's no easy way out. There's no way out without hurting someone. I just thought it was strange that that movie treated the situation with more I don't know, a more unromantic eye than this movie. Although this movie's all about romance, so whatever.
Yeah, we've got three storylines left. I think the one that I have the least to say, because it's the one that I keep forgetting was even in the movie, because it is such a radically different tone, is the one with Laura Linney and some other dude. I'm going to rely on Elliot to tell me real names of people here. But it's kind of a workplace crush, which is a classic sort of rom-com setup. But then Laura Linney's character has a brother who appears to have some mental some mental illness or some mental issues that require...
I would say schizophrenia, based on the symptoms that we see in the movie.
Well, I'm not a psychologist like Elliot. I'm not going to come on here and say what fictional characters are ailing with. but yeah, schizophrenia, that's as good a guess as any. And so she is... Her kind of workplace romance is being hindered by having to... constantly be on call and come to the aid of her brother. So I thought this was a good storyline. It's kind of hurt by being a significantly darker storyline than any of the other ones. Also a significantly more sad, yeah, just in general, more sad and realistic storyline. I thought it was good because this is, I would argue, another shade of love is, right, love for someone who can't really love you back in a way that, right, like, no amount of helping her brother is ever going to result in her brother loving her back, but she doesn't do it for that. She does it because, right, it's the right thing to do. She's taking care of someone she cares about. And so I thought it was a good storyline. I thought it was realistic. I think it's only hurt by the fact that, it's kind of tough to go from Hugh Grant's goofy hijinks singing Christmas carols to, you know, someone in a mental institute trying to help their brother out of a really difficult place. That's a bit of whiplash for me personally.
Yeah, I agree. I like the storyline okay. I do like the more realistic, just the other perspective, the promise of the movie in bringing these different perspectives to love, I think is well realized here. I feel like if anything, Carl is the name of her workplace crush, kind of interferes with this story, because he doesn't really play much of a part in it aside from he's basically a foil for the relationship between Sarah is her name, and Michael is her brother.
Yeah.
So I don't know that we needed that much. But yeah, I liked it. I liked it for the honesty that it had, and for, again, I liked the element of sacrifice that it brings to love. That this kind of relationship and this kind of care, requires it's not all boom boxes and learning new languages. Like, it requires a certain level of sacrifice, which I think it makes it more impactful. I sound very defensive right now. it's not because I'm just angry and old. I feel like that makes it more impactful because it makes it more meaningful that something is actually lost, or a decision is made to pursue a relationship and to be there for someone, sometimes at personal expense. And just for the record, I think he's schizophrenic because he has a delusion of persecution because he thinks the nurses are poisoning him, and a sort of hindered emotional expression. He's very monotone. He doesn't really, he says that in the tone of voice that is not really commensurate with the intensity of the problem being described, which is again typical of a schizophrenic patient.
I would agree I think Carl is the weakest part of the storyline, as well as because it doesn't feel like he does anything. Like, after the office party, he goes back to whatever woman name you said, back to her flat, and then he has to leave because Michael has an episode that she has to go and take care of. And after that, it seems like there's no Carl is never like, hey, how can I, like, I'm still into you, so I'd really like to find a way to, like, work this out in a way where I can be in a relationship with you and you can keep taking care of your brother. So it was kind of weird to me that Carl did nothing. Also, I will say, Carl is, like, insanely jacked, and his sweaters are doing nothing to, like... This was the first time in a movie ever where, like, clothes and someone wearing glasses did successfully convince me that I was like, yeah, he's okay looking, but he's not great. And then, like, he took off his sweater, and I was like, actually, he's jacked. That's insane. He looks incredible. But anyway, now we land on the final two stories. And I would say, I think both of these are decent stories that are buoyed by the fact that Liam Neeson and Emma Thompson are incredible actors. That they really lock down these storylines and make me care way more about them than I would normally. That Liam Neeson's is his wife has recently passed, and he's trying to take care of her son. I don't think it's his son. But he's trying to take care of her son, and this son has a crush on one of the girls in his school. And I thought this storyline was really made by Liam Neeson, that I think he does an amazing job of portraying someone who is grieving and going through something very difficult, and he's found a project, in this case, his son's crush on this girl, to put his energy into, and that he's very invested in his son's attempts to woo this woman. He also shows, they watch Titanic, which is not an appropriate movie to be watching with a child of this age. The kid looks like he's, I don't know, 10, 11 or something. Not old enough for Titanic, in my opinion. But it's a pretty good story. It's got the airport run finale. I liked it a fair amount. And kind of same with Emma Thompson and Alan Rickman's story, which is that Alan Rickman is, I don't know if he ever does actually cheat on her, but he's for sure encouraging his assistant, who's inexplicably into him, because he's, you know, Alan Rickman's not unattractive, but he's like a noticeably old, he looks like a professor in every scene. I don't know why this woman is so nutty about him. But he's kind of encouraging, he gets her a gift that Emma Thompson knows he has and thinks is for her, and then it turns out that he gave this gift to his assistant, and so she thinks he's cheating on him, on her, and he's definitely encouraging something that he should be shutting down. And this is another storyline that I think is very good because Emma Thompson really kills this as someone who's trying to deal with the thought of their spouse being unfaithful and trying to put on a brave face in front of her children. I really, really, probably my favorite movie moment in the entire movie is when she runs into David, which is Hugh Grant's character, who is her brother. When she runs into him and she just like hugs him and kind of breaks down for a second, I thought that was such an amazing moment because much like the Billy Mack thing, it was depicting a mode of love that wasn't present in a lot of the other movie, that it was just like, wow, seeing a sibling or someone you know that you can rely on in moments where you feel like the bottom has dropped down, like that's such a huge thing. And I thought that was a really beautiful moment of that. But I thought both of these storylines, I think, is okay. They have their issues. I think their endings are kind of, well, especially the Alan Rickman thing goes nowhere and doesn't feel like it has even an ending, which is frustrating to me. So there's some negatives for both of these storylines, but I think Liam Neeson and Emma Thompson really carried them for me with their performance.
Okay, that's kind of two in one.
That's because we're running out of time, Elliot. We gotta move quickly.
Oh my gosh. Fine. I would say that I like the one, it's Harry, Karen, and Mia. Harry is Alan Rickman, Mia is the secretary, and Karen is Emma Thompson. And you're right, Mia is, she is powerfully lusting after this middle-aged, slightly overweight man with a receding hairline. Which, whatever, man. I mean, that's her thing. I feel like I liked the idea of this story more than the story itself, because I think that all of the ingredients for something very powerful and very moving are there, but I would agree it really peters out at the end.
Yeah.
That you have this, honestly, very affecting, moving discovery from Karen, and the way that she puts on a brave face, I thought was, yeah, very, very sympathetic and really made me like her as a character and root for her. But, yeah, at the end, it's just she confronts Harry about it, and he says, "I've been a fool," and that's the end. And that is, that's just very unsatisfying. So I don't even know what happens. Like, do they just decide this will just be a sham marriage from now on? Do they make amends? I don't know. So I feel like they really copped out there.
Yeah.
But I definitely agree. Emma Thompson, she is bringing it here. She's giving a great performance. There's that. I did enjoy the bit where Harry tries to buy the gold necklace, and the attendant, Rowan Atkinson, is being too slow for his liking. I just like Mr. Bean.
Really?
And I find... What's wrong with Mr. Bean?
Well, I thought that was a part of the movie where I was like, this is for the British folks who love Mr. Bean, and I've never understood people's fondness for that character or his antics. It wasn't annoying to me, but I was like, this is a really long bit that I don't find very funny. So that's interesting.
Have you ever seen Mr. Bean?
No, I've seen clips, and I don't find them funny. So that's
of course, yeah, that makes sense. That's absolutely legitimate, 100%. That's me being sarcastic, by the way.
I was gonna say that was done very dryly. I couldn't tell. Look, I've seen clips. Why should I have to watch the whole thing to know I won't like something? If I don't like a clip, why would I like the whole thing?
No, fair enough. I mean, that's the same reason why I say I don't like Rick and Morty without having actually watched a full episode of the show.
You wouldn't like it, so that's a fair thing for you to say.
Anyway, so that's... I feel like that's that storyline is a storyline without an ending, which is disappointing. And then, I liked the one with... Hold on a second, let me check. Daniel, Sam, Joanna, and Carol. Mm. Daniel is Liam Neeson. Sam is the son. Joanna is his love interest. And then Carol is just... It's just like this woman that they insert at the last minute for Liam Neeson to have a meet cute with.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really stupid. I thought this storyline was fine. I don't really care for precocious kid characters. But Liam Neeson definitely adds a level of gravitas and pathos that the storyline without which I think this storyline would probably rank pretty low for me. Mm. But he is definitely, his performance and his character are both very sympathetic and very moving, and they manage to more or less paper over the cracks of the writing deficiencies.
Yeah. Well, that's all nine. We did it. In terms of comments for the whole movie, I do think the movie is not edited super well in terms of deciding when to cut back to storylines, that there were times that it felt like we spent a lot of time away from the bigger storylines, that I feel like there's periods where Harry and Karen's storyline gets dropped, where David and Natalie's storyline gets dropped, and I think that there exists a version of this movie that's edited to weave the stories in a little more seamlessly, or a little more evenly, so everything is getting good amounts of screen time, and there's never periods where you're just like, dang, David has not shown up for a while. But I think in general, yeah, the stuff that we said at the beginning of the movie, I think it's fine. I mean, most of the storyline, I think there was only like two storylines that were genuinely annoying to me and just subtracted from my enjoyment of the film. For the most part, all of the storylines I think are okay to like good. I wouldn't say that there's a storyline that is just like an unequivocal, wow, that's a masterpiece. But they're mostly decent. They're mostly decent, in my opinion.
Yeah, apologies if there you got a little cameo from Shadow. He's got something to say, and he wants the world to hear it.
So true.
Anyway, yeah, I feel, as a package, again, I think this movie's okay. It's definitely got some, at this point, I feel like it has a little bit of old school charm, just from, this movie is from an era of rom-coms that doesn't really exist anymore, so there was a bit of camp value to it. But yeah, I think that I agree, the stories are not really integrated very seamlessly, and like I said at the beginning, there's a lot of them. And some of them don't work as well as the others. And one of them is an abject failure. So it's kind of like when we talked about Monty Python, how in the moments when they go all in on a joke or a bit that doesn't work for you, like it's just the movie just flatlines.
Yeah.
But that's the risk that you take in bringing all of these many characters and storylines into a single movie. So I can definitely give this movie some points in the ambition department, that they set out to do something that was difficult, it was always going to be tricky, and the fact that they didn't quite make it there is certainly a point against the movie, but I appreciate that they tried. That's the only thing that matters, is trying, giving it your best shot.
Yeah, that's why all of our ratings are participation trophies. Yes. I give this movie a participation trophy. You made a movie. Congrats.
I mean, honestly, it's tough to make a movie. It is more than I have ever done. And I'm happy to sit here and call it trash. And sometimes it is. But there is always at least a low level of respect for putting in the work. Unless your movie is called Megalopolis.
Wow. Anyway, I'm ready to do a final rating if you are.
Let's do it.
Okay. Well, my final rating might seem a little low based on how many kind of like positive things I said about this movie. But you have to understand, most of the positive things I said about this movie was just that it wasn't bad, not that it was like great. Like, Emma Thompson and Liam Neeson are bringing it. They're doing a great job. They're doing a great job elevating plot lines that I think without them would be mediocre to bad. So I'm going to give the movie a 6.6 out of 10. I think it's better than mediocre. You wouldn't have to, like, twist my arm super hard to make me watch it again. But it's unlikely I would ever choose to watch it again, and I do think it could be edited better. I think the storylines that are bad, Colin, it genuinely might be like a point and a half just for the existence of Colin and such an awful character who I dislike so much. And giving him a happy ending, too. Like, Emma Thompson doesn't get a happy ending, but this Colin guy does? That's ridiculous.
That's a good point. Sure. Sorry, I was a little distracted by Shadow there. I think this movie's fine. I'm not sad that I watched it. I would never, like you, I would never choose to watch it again myself. But if somebody stood up and started, like, putting it in the DVD player, I wouldn't, like, try to tackle them to the ground and stop them. Actually, I wouldn't do that no matter what, because it's just a bad thing to do.
Yeah.
But I might there are some movies that I would probably voice opposition to. No one cares. This is just
what
rambling.
A great metric we've come up with.
Anyway, there are parts of this movie that I like, parts of it that I hate, and most of it I'm just kind of like, yeah, all right, towards. Definitely some good performances here. Gavin is one of the best characters in movie history. And yeah, I think that I'm going to give it a C+. Wow. It's like average, but good average.
Wow. Well, then let's do some recommendations. I am not going to recommend a Christmas movie here. Instead, I'm going to talk about a rom-com, my favorite rom-com. I don't believe I've mentioned this on this podcast before, but there's also like 130-some episodes of this, so it's possible I have. But my recommendation, if you're looking for another romantic comedy to watch after Love Actually, that honestly, in my opinion, does some of the same things as Love Actually better than it, that's going to be When Harry Met Sally. It is an 80s classic, in my opinion, and it is the best, most convincing romance story that I think is in any movie ever. I love this movie. I think it's so funny. I think it's so well done. It has a really, really clever recurring motif of real-life couples telling the story of how they met, which I think does a ton to make the coincidences that appear in this movie, in this movie's main storyline, very believable. Because when you hear some of these real stories of how couples met, you're like, wow, that's hard to believe that's how you met your husband. So when Harry randomly runs into Sally somewhere, it's very believable. I think it is just the most romantic movie. It has so many great scenes. The lines at the end when Harry does the classic rom-com run and confesses his love are just some of the best, most romantic lines in movie history, in my opinion. The sweaters are amazing. It's genuinely funny. It's genuinely romantic. I'm a huge fan of this movie. So my recommendation is going to be When Harry Met Sally.
Okay. That movie's all right.
Yeah, I know you don't like it as much.
Not that I dislike it. It's just, yeah, I don't like it as much. My recommendation is going to be something that brings a little bit more of a flair and a little bit more of a unique twist to the romantic movie formula, which is one of the things that, like I said, was a little bit lacking from this movie. That's going to be The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. This is a movie, it's the only good, what's his name?
Charlie Kaufman.
Yes, this is the only good movie that Charlie Kaufman has ever made in his entire life. I'm sorry, Charlie.
He didn't even make this one. He's only the writer. This is Spike Jonze.
That's terrible. Wow. He's just not very good, is he?
Wow.
Anyway, this is a movie about two people who fall in love and then fall out of love. And Jim Carrey wants to wipe Kate Winslet out of his memory. And I think this movie, it's not particularly funny. I wouldn't say it's a rom-com.
No.
But it's definitely a romance movie. And the fact that it takes place mostly in these kind of like surreal dreamscapes where Jim Carrey is looking back on his relationship and thinking about the things that he wants to keep from it, I feel like is a lot more interesting than your average romance because it's more about romance than it is just about two people getting together. That it's about the pain, the things that are good, the things that are bad, and whether or not it's worth it in the end if it all falls apart. So I really like it. I find it very compelling, very moving. Yes, Shadow, I'll get to you in just a minute. And yeah, I really appreciate that that little something extra that it brings to this recognizable, well-worn formula.
Yeah, I agree. I haven't seen that movie in a while, but I think it's really interesting, and I'm not as much of a Charlie Kaufman hater as you are, so I think it's one of a couple of Charlie Kaufman movies that are worth giving a watch. Yeah, thanks so much for listening.
Life is hard and full of disappointments.
Yeah. This always with this hard and disappointment with this guy.
It's true.
Thank you so much for listening to this extra long Christmas episode. We've got some other Christmas goodies for you. Starting next week, we're going to be doing, we don't know what we're doing yet, but you can rest assured that in the coming weeks, you're going to be able to hear our thoughts on the movies from this year, our recap, our best of list, our worst of list, all of the stuff you've come to expect from the year-end Magellans at the Movies. We also are going to be doing a list-making episode, making our top 10 movies of the 90s list. That'll be, I think it's going to be the most contentious one to date, because there's already movies that I know Elliot is going to have to fight like the Dickens to get on there. And I'm pretty sure he feels the same about some of my movies. So it's going to be interesting. Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to tune in when those things come out. And have a great rest of your year.